of companies at the moment that I'm just advising over the phone. I've met them a couple of times, and I just keep phoning them going, how many stores have you got?
Okay.
And they go, 200, forget about it, get 1,000.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I got 3,500 in a year by just staying in bed and breakfast and driving from town to town. And that's how I saved the company.
Hello, and welcome to episode 25 of The Entrepreneur Experiment. I'm your host, Gary Fox. The Entrepreneur Experiment is a weekly business podcast. It goes out every Thursday at 6 a.m. where I sit down and chat to some of Ireland's most interesting entrepreneurs. This week, we have a really special guest. Gary was on my hit list from before I actually started the podcast. So before I started the podcast, I made a list of 50 people I wanted to interview. And Gary was up there in the top 10. We sat down and had a really interesting chat about scaling, not just an Irish business, but a global business. As a solo entrepreneur, I'm fascinated by what motivates fellow entrepreneurs and how to sustain that motivation over a long time. Listening to Gary tell his story back, his perseverance in the early years is just something that's kind of hard to fathom now. Everyone's looking for that instant success, that internet business that just scales immediately within 12 months. And Gary just shares what it actually takes to build a sustainable long-term business. Gary, for those of you not familiar with it, is the founder of VitHit Drinks. VitHit will sell 25 million units across the globe this year. An absolute huge Irish success story. I hope you enjoy the episode. Next week, we're taking a short break as we've reached our 26th episode. We'll be taking a 1 week break as I'm taking a little holiday myself. And I will see you back in 2 weeks' time, Thursday at 6 a.m. Enjoy this week's episode. And as always, do share the episode on social media if you've enjoyed it, and do get in touch with any feedback you have. The last couple of weeks has been a huge increase in people getting in touch with their feedback and their thoughts and their ideas, and it means an absolutely massive amount. So thank you very much for anyone that's got in touch with me. Enjoy this week's chat with Gary Lavin. Gary, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much for having me.
Just give us a quick intro as to who you are.
My name is Gary Lavin. I am the founder and chairman of VitHit Drinks. I created vitamin drinks almost 20 years ago now, and they eventually morphed into what you see on the shelves across Europe now, which is VitHit.
So 20 years ago, healthy drinks were rare?
Extremely rare, and so was selling healthy drinks. No one wanted them. I was a sole trader, pretty much. I spent probably 8 to 10 years finding my way. It took probably 11 years to actually make a profit. So I was doing other things at the time, financing it through various different ways, friends and family, buying and selling apartments when you could actually make money out of it. Yeah, it was something that I always believed. I was always very anti-sugar from my rugby playing days. I always knew the dangers of sugar when at the time no one else did. So when I first started, people thought that sports drinks were healthy for you. And I knew from playing sports that they had 28 grams of sugar per bottle and your body can only process 25 grams of sugar. So I knew that this was a big problem. And I started creating my own low-calorie, low-sugar vitamin drinks. Took a long time for me to even get it across to the retailers, never mind the public.
Was this your first venture? You've listed a couple of things you were doing simultaneously there, but was it hit your first idea?
No, I did a lot of different things. I was a professional sports player. I was a rugby player getting paid for doing what I loved. When the game went from amateur to professional, which was back in 1995. So I did that for about a year and a half, got injured, bust my knee and had to get a real job. So
was that here in Ireland or abroad?
That was abroad. I was at a few caps for Leinster in an amateur area, and then I went over and played for Harlequins in the UK, and that's when I got injured. So that was a time of reflection. But at the time, I guess I felt I wasn't really realizing my potential because I loved rugby. I was going to do it for free anyway, and getting paid for it. And then during the day, you'd have lots of downtime. And I was doing things like playing video games. And I just felt a little bit like a loser. So I was kind of like, right, I better go do something. So what I was doing at the time was I was buying and selling proteins and creatines and performance products to all my friends who played rugby in the UK, guys that I played rugby with in London Irish and Wasps and various different things. That's kind of how I got into nutrition. That was my general day-to-day. So in my downtime, rather than sitting around and playing video games, I was buying and selling products.
Good way to pass the day.
Yeah, yeah. And I skipped past one of my more embarrassing business moments. back in the 1991 Rugby World Cup in Ireland, I created these products called Bummers, and I thought that everyone would want to sit on a branded cushion that I created for Lansdowne Road, the old Lansdowne Road stands. And the business turned out to be a bit of a bummer because I made something like 6,000 seats and I sold about 100 of them.
You were selling them outside, was it?
I was selling them outside the ground, yeah. No license. I didn't need one back in the day. But yeah, I ended up with a lot of bummer seats, which were my branded seats.
And how did you... So you were only playing rugby for a couple of years and got injured. Mm. Did you know what you want to do straight after that, or how did you transition over?
Well, I kind of, when that happened, you know, when your focus is everything in one direction, you really have to do a 180. And at the time, I remember saying, I never want to put my future in someone else's hands again, because when I got injured, the manager said to me, look, your contract is gone. And they could rip up your contract back then. That we didn't have any insurance or anything like that. So it was a total shock to me. And I remember being over in the UK, actually, I ended up wandering. Into Twickenham, and I remember thinking to myself, I'm never going to let anybody else do this to me again. So I had been buying and selling products, so I said, look, I'll just do that full time now. So I just went into creating my own products, and I created a vitamin brand, which I sold some products into Boots. But I was really only finding my way. I was, you know, I'd have been better off getting a job with somebody and working as a salesman and finding out what to do. I was literally totally blind. I just invested the money that I had, went to a manufacturer, created some vitamins which I thought might sell, and got them into Boots in the UK. And I never really had any passion for that business. I didn't really enjoy it that much. It was literally just like selling a widget. I just wasn't really into it. So I kind of said, I was about 2 years into that business, and then I kind of said, well, look, I like health. Why don't I try and put, healthy drinks together? Because, it was something... I obviously liked tasty drinks, and I liked vitamins, and I liked health, so why not put them all together? And that was kind of where the acorn of the idea started.
Okay, so you kind of chipped away at a few different ideas. You kind of see that in a lot of entrepreneurs. They kind of chip away around the area of where they want to go before eventually finding that little nugget of spark. Where did that come from for you?
I always say that all of these little steps where actually, you're losing money, you are in some circles, you could say you're failing, but it's not a failure unless you actually give up. So, were the marathon runners who were trying to break the minute mile, were those guys failing when they were getting gold medals at Olympics? They were just failing to get their 4 minute mile, but
I
they
love
weren't
that
failing.
Analogy. Yeah. I like that.
So for me, I was trying to stay positive. I was learning my way through it. And I was actually the real crux of it was, I was actually in a gym one day and I saw this guy sweating, running for approximately 30 minutes. And I was watching him, and he's really putting in a huge effort. And I noticed what he had on his treadmill. He had a sports drink, which I knew had 28 grams of sugar. And I knew that if you run for 30 minutes, you burn about 180 calories, which is equivalent to around 25 grams of sugar. And he got off and he finished and he was really proud of himself, and he just swigged out of the bottle and downed the whole bottle of sugar and calories. And I just looked at this and I was like, my God, there has to be another way. Mm. So that was really the turning point for me. I said, why don't I just try and, instead of putting vitamins directly out of packets into people's mouths, why don't I just blend them into a nice tasting product? Because I never liked taking vitamins. To this day, I can't swallow vitamins, so that's why I drink a bottle of Vidit a day, because you can get all your vitamins that way without the sugars.
But 20 years ago, though, you're talking about the sports drink to say, I think people didn't really have a knowledge of sugar, but even now I'd say you must still be educating people on that.
I still have to, yeah. It's something that is coming, and you look around today, especially in Ireland now, if you go, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, you get up in the morning and your drive to work at 7 in the morning, you wouldn't see anybody out jogging. You go to a gym, of which there were only about 6 in the country, or in Dublin.
Yeah.
Now you go out, there's thousands of people out running in the morning, people are cycling, everybody's healthier, they're walking. So we now realise the effects, but that was really only the tip of the iceberg. We still have a huge obesity problem here in Ireland, and it's getting worse. So yeah, if I could just spend 1 hour with every school kid in the country once a year, I would basically say to them, a really important message is learn how to read, know how bad sugar is for you, and learn how to read the back of packs. So a kid's body can only process 15 grams of sugar a day, and an adult can only process 25 grams of sugar a day. And just to put that into context, you know, a sports drink has 28 grams of sugar, a bottle of cola has about 26 to 28 grams of sugar. So after you drink one of those products, you can't have a grape for the rest of the day. You're overdoing your sugar. And there's sugar hidden in everything. And, you know, I drink sugar, I eat sugar, but I just know what's going in. So, you know, and the excess sugar, our livers can't process it, and we end up getting fat. And that's what's happening. The sugar, sugar, fat and salt are into all of the meals that we have day in, day out. And you just need to be aware of it and just reduce it. And you'll save yourself a lot of hassle.
You told me something there about proportion of school kids in Ireland being obese. What is sparking that? Is it sugar?
Yeah, and all the research has shown that it's sugar. If you look at any of the stats, there's actually two things. I can't 100% blame it on sugar. It's also the ready-made food aspect. So if you look at the 70s and you look at photographs of school kids in the 70s versus photographs now, back in the 70s and 80s, there was only one kid approximately who would be marginally overweight. Mm. Now there's 30% of our school kids are obese. And so the difference is partially, yes, we are over-consuming sugar. But the other important difference is that we're snacking way too often. We eat when we're hungry. And the human body is actually designed to eat, you know, once and then forage and go and find food or kill a lion or whatever else you're going to eat for the day. So we've, you know, in the past 30 to 40 years, we've changed that. So we're hungry, we walk across the road, we buy a Mars bar. We're hungry, you know, we go across the road and we buy a Twix or we buy a muffin or whatever. And so that's where all the fat and sugars are coming in. But there's way too much sugars in our diet too. So that there's two main reasons why there's a massive change. And we need to educate people and we need to fix that. But, you know, my job is not just to make Vidit successful, but I'm kind of trying to tell people, look, you really, really don't need all of those sugars in your day, and you just need to know how to count them. And so, sure, if you want to have biscuits, go have biscuits, but just know how much sugar you're getting in those biscuits.
Trade it off somewhere else.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, like, even what you're saying now, very common sense, but there's a lot of kind of ingrained knowledge in people is, oh, this is healthy for me, certain things are healthy. But back 20 years ago, surely you were coming up against a brick wall for a lot of retailers and things like that when you started with it.
Yeah, I was. I remember my first retailer was BWG, who are Spar. And I went into the Spar buyer, who's now one of their directors, and he said to me, oh, not another sports drink. And I said to him arrogantly, no, this is not another sports drink. In fact, you've never seen anything like this. And he was like, wow, I'm impressed your arrogance. He says, I'll list you. So, that's kind of how it started. But yeah, it took a long time for people to be educated. And one of the things that I learned was when I actually started the drink, the company was called Vitz, V-I-T-Z, and I got the branding wrong. So my products weren't always called Vithit. They've been called Vithit for the last, let's say, 9 to 10 years. But at the start, it was called Vitz because I, in my overcomplicated head, thought that Vitz meant vitamins, V-I-T-Z it was. And after 3 or 4 years of losing a lot of money, I couldn't afford to do research. So I went to a college and I said, look, guys, can you do some research for me? Do a blind test. They loved the flavors, some of which are still the same today. And then they said, okay, well, what do you think of the brand? And they looked at it and they said, oh, it must be German. You know, they thought it was Vitz. And that was like a eureka moment for me. I was like, wow, I really need to make this more obvious. So I sat at home and I fretted for maybe 3 weeks, and eventually I woke up literally in the middle of the night and I went Vithit. And I went online and I was amazed to see that Vithit.com was available. So I registered Vithit.com. This is probably, gosh, this was probably 04, I'd say. And from that point, we rebranded, not to the exact branding that we had today, but we just literally kept changing from Vitz to Vithit. And suddenly the product sales went up about 100%. So that was a big lesson for me. You have to be really, really obvious on what you're going to do.
Do you think that was entirely down to the name?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
Same bottle, same product.
Really?
And slight difference in packaging. But yeah, the brand name. Because it's since been realized you only have 0.4 of a second to convince a consumer on the shelf to grab the product. So literally it's an eye scan and you're looking from left to right. You can probably scan 50 feet in that time. So something's got to grab you. So if you walk by on a shelf and you see Vits, you're like, don't know what that is. But if you walk by and you see Vit Hit, oh, that must be vitamins. So then at least we've done half the job.
Yeah.
You know? And after that, then once you taste it, which is step two, obviously it's a taste is extremely important to me. I spend between 9 months and a year on each one of our flavors. Which I know that other companies don't do that. I suppose it was like back to my rugby days. If I was training harder than anybody else, I figured I'd do better. I wanted it more. And it's the same with flavors. I spent so long perfecting the flavors and getting them right. And I know other companies are not doing that. And that's one of the reasons why we're doing better than
that. A friend of mine, Shane Monaghan, he played rugby similar to yourself at quite a high level. He played in England as well. And he puts down his self-belief to his rugby background. Did that have a big impact on you as well?
Oh, absolutely. I think sports are incredible for young people to give you self-belief. I always call it a bit of healthy arrogance. And it's one of the reasons why I kept going when everybody else was giving up. Like I said, I had lots of little failures along the way, but I never really branded them as failures because I thought I was bulletproof. Because when I was younger, on the rugby field, I felt bulletproof.
Yeah.
And you take that win on, you know, through the rest of your life. So it gives you a hell of a lot of self-confidence. Sports is incredible for that. And I was actually in a cab recently, and another lesson we're always learning, but the cab driver turned to me and he said, I had a present in my hand for my daughter, and he said, and she's going on two. And he said, oh, I've got a couple of girls. And he said, do you know what's the most important thing for girls when they're young? And I said, what's that? And he said, team sports. And I said, wow, that's interesting, because I said, that's what I would love my kid to do.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, he said, a stat came out recently that 80% of women on boards in America played team sports competitively. I was like, that cannot be true.
That does sound like one of those ones that's made up.
And I Googled it, and Dr. Google says it's true.
Really?
So what that to me says is that, certainly in Ireland, you know, girls are often thought, you can't do that, you know, you can't do it like a guy can, you throw like a girl, all that, those kind of things. And I think about these things more now. And one of the things that I have realised is that when you tell a young girl, you can do that, you're great, and then they play competitive sports and they realise that they are really good at something, then they have confidence to break glass ceilings and they go into companies and they succeed. And that's obviously what's happened. So, I mean, there's a huge life lesson there for parents.
Yeah. That the Women's World Cup this year felt like a bit of a tipping point, I think. It was very mainstream.
Absolutely, yeah.
I've never seen...
I know, and well, women's football in America is actually bigger than men's football.
But so globally, to see that breakthrough was phenomenal.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think then the ripple effect that has when girls like your daughter and things like that see that on telly, but on mainstream
absolutely.
Telly.
Absolutely. They now have heroes who are girls.
Yeah.
Who can, you know, kick a ball like the guys can and all that kind of stuff. You can get that done. So then you take that on to your college life and you can compete with blokes, which they can, of course. And then they go into boardrooms and they feel they can compete. It's all about what you think you can do. So yeah, confidence is a huge thing. And just like your friend who's played rugby, you get that confidence at a young age. You kind of feel bulletproof. And it's probably the number one reason why I stuck at this business when everybody else, you know, sat back because they would have felt that it was a failure. Many times I was down, but, you know, you're always measured by how you get back up again.
So take us back to when you started. You had the idea for Vit Hit. How did you go about it? How did you go, right, okay, I'm going to make a drink?
Yeah, I was chatting to people recently and I basically said, look, you know, it's actually much easier now to get things done than it was back then, because we actually didn't have the internet when I started this. This is back in 1999. The internet, of course, was around, but I certainly didn't have it. I didn't have access to it. So I spent 2 years making phone calls, almost 2 years before, from the time I came up with the idea to actually producing my first bottle was about 2 years. So I was making phone calls. I found a guy, Richard Nash, he had Nash's Mineral Waters down in Limerick. I drove down to him, told him, you know, that I wanted to put healthy things into drinks. Didn't want to give away too much. And then he basically said to me, oh, well, you need to go to this company. They can formulate for you. And I flew over to Germany and I found, you know, an ingredients company over there. And they formulated for me.
You had a rough idea what you wanted.
Yeah, well, yeah, I knew I wanted low sugar. I knew I wanted lots of vitamins. I knew I wanted tasty and I wanted to look good. So I've always kept things really, really simple. I think people complicate businesses way too much. And I think, you know, and hence that's what happens when we changed the name of the product to Vit Hit. It was really simplifying it for people. So I have a thing in the office here that I call, you know, the ladybird version. When accountants come to me and they give me all these figures, I just say, give me the ladybird version. We make it for X, we sell it for Y, and we make Z.
I love that.
And that's all I need to know. I, you know, because I was never great in school. And again, sports gave me a lot of confidence, so it didn't really bother me because all kids are good at something. But I just wasn't good at the national quiz, which I call the leaving cert. I just, bad memory. And so from that point onwards, I was just like, you know, own what, you, what you're good at. You know, I know I'm good at creating and sales. And I was never good at memory or accountancy or any of that kind of stuff. So I just focus on what I'm good at. And one of the things is just simplifying a message to people and getting that message out as quickly as possible.
There's such a talent in that, though, of making complex things simple.
Yeah.
I think the people that can do that are the ones that win out, like yourself with the branding and just being able to make something quite complicated a one line.
Yeah, but it seems obvious to me because it's the way I think. Mm. I don't think in complicated
ways. It's so rare.
Ways.
Because people try and make things complicated to show, look how much I know.
That's a perfect example
this.
For kids in that, you know, in school, if I wasn't good at sports, I would, you know, I would have thought, wow, I'm a total failure. And,
yeah.
And I wouldn't have had that success in any area of sport. And I would have been like, wow, I'm not good at things. You know, whereas school just focuses on one thing. Memory. It's a general memory quiz. That's really all it is. And if you're not good at that, you know, what else can you be good at? And okay, then the sports. There's two things. But I mean, there's so many things that kids can be good at, and you just need to find those things. And I have always kept things simple because I think in simple ways, and I just try and pass on messages, which works if you're in my business, because you can basically show someone a product and they go, oh, fit it, that works. But yeah, back to the original, you know, did I have any overblown ideas of it? You know, yes, I was always very ambitious, but when I went over to Germany to set these things up, I just figured, look, I have a middle of the road Irish taste buds. If I like it, most people are going to like it. And I just stuck with that. So, you know, I'd be sitting there with a few technicians and they'd be giving me various different ones. And I was always very sure in what I wanted. And to this day, we actually don't do any consumer focus groups on taste or anything like that. I taste it first. If I like it, then I'll throw it around to the team here. And if they all go, it's absolutely terrible, then sure, I won't go ahead. But if they actually go, yeah, I quite like that, then we'll probably run with it, because that's what's worked in the past, just keeping it really simple.
And how many flavors did you start with then? You went over to Germany and you had an idea for a couple of flavors, or you worked with them to develop?
We had about four flavors at the start, and we're always chopping and changing. It's like we take the wounded wildebeest at the back. He gets eaten by the lion, and we bring in another one. So we sometimes switch out our weakest flavor and bring in another one, and then if that should overtake the previous weakest one, we'll drop that off slowly. That's kind of what we do. When we go into new countries, we'll always try and start with four. Although retailers these days are trying to take less and less, so when we launch with, you know, recently actually a big retailer said, okay, we'll take two of your products, and we said, no thanks, we're not going on the shelf, because we know we'll fail with two products.
Okay.
You have to have at least three products, and ideally four, on the shelf if you want to succeed. Because if you go into a new country, let's say recently we went into Holland or Belgium, and they've never heard of Vittit. If you just have two products on the shelf, the consumer is not going to see it. You're not going to get the rate of sale. The retailer is going to delist you anyway, and your short-term gain is not going to be worth it. So we now say, look, if you don't take at least three flavors on, thanks, but no thanks, we won't go ahead.
So how long between starting meeting the guys in Germany to seeing your first bottle of Vitz as it was on the shelf?
Back then, it was probably, I'd been working on it for 2 years before I went, for about a year and a half before I went to Germany. So it was 6 months after that.
Okay.
So it was probably, monetary-wise, it was probably, I mean, how can you put a price on your hours? But outside my hours, what it actually cost to produce the first amount, I think it was around 6,000 to 8,000 euros at the time. Or was it pounds back then? I don't know.
Probably
it was
pounds.
Euros, pounds. Anyway, so it's around that much, which was a hell of a lot of money back then.
Yeah, absolutely.
But again, you know, I was kind of arrogant and foolish, and I just said, listen, this is going to work, because I think it's going to work.
Yeah.
And that was, but then first got the product there, stuck it on the shelf and didn't really sell, and then I had to recheck myself, and then we got Vittit, and then it started growing, but it still was only doing very, very minimal amounts. And
did you start here in Ireland?
Started here in Ireland, thought that I could go abroad, and that was a mistake. So basically the big turning point was about 13 years ago, when I was still losing money in the company. So we'd been losing money for about 7 years. I realized, again, knowing what I'm good and what I'm bad at, that I was bad with accounts. I needed to get someone involved. So I got a business partner, Ian, who's still with us today. And he basically, his job was to look at the figures. So after about 6 months, he came back and he said, look, these figures are not good. I was like, okay. And he said, I'm going to take you to see an accountant. And we went to see a lady who was pretty much a forensic accountant. And she looked at the figures and she said, look, I've seen 23 companies in this state. I've rescued one of them. And she said, if you don't do what I say, you're going to the wall. And I was like, right. So she said, you're the second one we're going to rescue. But she said, what you need to do, Gary, she said, you need to get in your car and stop designing products and stop doing all the fancy jobs you like. I always call it stop skipping leg day in the gym. So I was metaphorically skipping leg day. So I said, okay, what do I need to do? And she said, you need to basically get in your car and you need to go across the country and sell it into store by store. Because she said, the product's great. It obviously sells well in stores, but just not in enough stores. So she said, Ian, you need to sit in an office and, well, in his house, because we didn't have an office. And you need to do all the accounts. And Gary, you need to go and sell. And
she said, had you any idea how bad things were before you saw her?
No. It was one of the problems with not focusing in school. I didn't know. When we sat down and actually had a look at it, we figured that we really only had about 3 months left and the company was insolvent anyway, and we were going to have to close down. So I guess that was the shock that I needed. We had two sales reps at the time. Three sales reps. I had to let them go because I couldn't afford to pay myself. I hadn't taken a wage in a year and a half myself. So we just knuckled down, and instantly within 2 months of really focusing on the right things, we broke even. And
wow, that quickly.
Yeah, that quickly. Literally changed from all of the overheads we had were wages, paying people who weren't selling enough. And no one can sell the product like yourself.
Yeah.
And it's funny, you know, I sit down with young Irish companies all the time now. They phone me and they text me, and I always meet them. You know, don't charge them. I just meet them to give them advice because I don't want them to go through the hardship that I went through back in the day. And I would always say to them, first thing is just get in the car yourself and you've got to go selling. So there's a couple of companies at the moment that I'm just advising over the phone. I've met them a couple of times and I just keep phoning them going, how many stores have you got?
Okay.
And they go, 200. Forget about it. Get 1,000.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I got 3,500 in a year by just staying in bed and breakfast and driving from town to town. And that's how I saved the company.
Was that all around Ireland? You just literally went town to town?
Just around Ireland,
to
yeah. I branded up a Jeep and just drove from town to town, yeah.
Phenomenal.
Yeah, back in 2009, I think it was. Yeah. So it wasn't that long ago.
Middle of the recession as well-ish.
Where we had all our growth. Our recession came before the recession. And actually all our recovery came during the recession.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I think as well, it wasn't just all of us. It was luck. You know, people started to become more healthy around then. I remember listening to the radio and everybody was saying, oh, you know, I've lost this, I've lost that. And on the radio, they were saying, you know, just try and get a pair of runners and go out and run and make yourself feel better. And that was a big sea change in Ireland as well. I think around that time, people really started to embrace exercise. So it was partly us realizing what we'd been doing wrong, and it was also partly that the consumer came towards us as well.
So you would literally go into, say, I'm from Nina, you'd go into Nina and you'd say, guys, we just try VitHit, take X amount.
Yeah, I'd fill the van for samples, and we had a distributor who could deliver after me, but they just were box movers, they weren't sellers. So I would I would drive to Ballina, for instance, and I would spend 5 hours there calling into the top 10 stores.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of the times the manager wouldn't be there, but on average I used to get, and this is what I say to people, you know, if you're focused, you can get 10 to 15 accounts a day.
Wow.
And if you are getting 10 to 15 accounts a day and you're selling 3 cases in, and, you know, each case is 10 euros worth, you know, you can turn over a pretty significant sum pretty quickly. And again, once I simplified it and brought it back to what I'm good at, And I was basically like, okay, if I can sell, you know, 10 accounts a day and I can make 300 euros and I can make a profit of, let's say, 100 euros and I can do that 5 days a week, that's 500 euros, you know, and just
simple,
literally
simple things, yeah, simple yeah,
bring
basics.
Bring it back to ladybird economics. So, and that's what I started to do. And that then gave me a real buzz because I knew every time I would sell one case, I knew exactly how much money I'd make on it.
Yeah.
And so I drove and I stayed in B&Bs and I drove all across the country. And I'd go into the stores and I'd basically say to the owner, listen, has the owner of Coca-Cola been in here with you today? And they'd go, no. And I say, well, I'm the owner of this company. Will you list the products? And they'd kind of laugh or whatever. But, you know, it's good for them as well because you're not just another sales rep. You're a guy who really cares about the brand and they see the passion in your eyes. You know, when I go and sell the product, nobody sells a product like I do because I have a passion for it and I believe, you know, genuinely 100% that our product is better than anything else out there. And that comes across when you sell it. You can't get that from, you know, we have some great employees, but no one's going to sell it as much as you are yourself.
I think anyone that works in sales will probably be listening going, that's so tough what you did.
It is, and I actually used to, but I love it. I mean, I actually really enjoy it now. I hardly ever do it anymore, but I did it. We moved to Australia for 3 months last November through to January because I wanted to help launch it over there. And I got back in the cars with the sales reps. And we had 100% sales record, so I haven't lost it.
Really? Yeah. In Australia, you went down and helped them start again?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, we were launching down there. I mean, it was also a nice thing to do because you're in Australia. I mean,
it's the worst places to go for the winter.
Exactly. I'm not going to say it was too tough. I'm not going to lie to you. This is a lie detector test, is it? So, I mean, I really enjoyed it. It is tough. And, you know, people say salespeople are born. I'm not so sure because I was always able to chat to people, you know, in a rugby club or in a bar or whatever, no problem. Mm. But I had this thing that I didn't really like cold calling into accounts. So one of the companies I set up years ago, as I said at the start of this, was I set up a vitamin company and I had serious problems with actually cold calling into pharmacies. I remember sitting outside one in, what town was it? I think it was Longford. And I remember sitting there going, I really don't want to go in here. And I remember there was a line in a song which I always remembered called Do One Thing Every Day That Scares You. And I used to have that as my motto. Yeah. So I used to just literally go, okay, go on in here. And eventually I broke that fear that I had. And for years I used to really actually enjoy calling into and I mean, I always say as well, like, what's the worst thing that can happen? Like, you know, maybe a pharmacist is going to have a bad day and he's going to like shout at you and kick you out of the store, but you can get over that and move on. And really, people in general are nice. I mean, I think I got, in my whole history of selling into places, I might have got 5 rude people.
Okay.
You know, and those same 5 rude people would be still rude today, 10 years later. Yeah. They're just miserable. Just, right? But most people are really friendly and really engaging. And you know, it's their job to talk to the sales reps every day. So once you get over that, it's really not a big deal.
How did you get over that? Because I think that's something we all... as an entrepreneur, I know how you feel. There's some days you're just dreading that one phone call and you know it's probably going to be fine, but you just dread it that little bit. Was it just continually putting yourself in a place of discomfort?
Yeah. Do one thing every day that scares you. It's a great motto to live by because no matter what you're doing, if you start from zero and you want to have, you know, a chocolate bar company in 5 years' time, you just take a step every day towards that. And a lot of the steps are uncomfortable. You have to make calls and you have to, you know, hire people, which is easy, and then you have to let them go, which is very, very difficult. Mm. I still, to this day, I can't, you know, I can't handle letting distributors go or, okay. You know, I fretted this year for about a week over a company that I had to get rid of in Europe, and because they were really nice people, but they just weren't performing well. So you never really get over that part. That's tough. But yeah, getting over the sales thing, you just push yourself, and eventually it becomes easy. And, you know, I suppose when I left school, I never really wanted to work for anybody. Both my parents were entrepreneurs, but I remember I got a temporary job in Dublin selling corporate packages to people in concerts. So I used to have to phone up. It was basically cold calling on phones. And I hated it. Every day I would have to go in and pick up a phone and go, can I speak to Mr. Tony O'Reilly, please? And you talk to his secretary and she'd go, why do you want to speak to him? Well, I'd really like to sell him. I remember this woman, Montserrat Caballé. Like, this was some opera singer that I had to sell. I never sold one ticket. But what it did do was it actually broke down a lot of barriers that I had of like cold calling. So it made it a little bit easier. So yeah, you can definitely shove 90% of people and get them to repeat, 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 and eventually it'll become easy.
Mm.
Yeah, I think anybody can become a salesperson. I really do.
So 2009, you spent how long on the road? 3, 4, 5 months?
Full year.
Full year?
Yeah.
Going around the country.
Yeah.
And then started selling, started moving off the shelf.
Yeah, I always felt that if it was on the shelf, it would sell.
Mm.
And I was, you know, we tinkered with the packaging a little bit. Never really tinkered with the flavours, because I always felt the flavours were right. Eventually, back around then, in 09, when the packaging was right, yeah, I would just get it into stores, get it on the shelves, and suddenly it started to tick. And then the next people kind of say to me, oh, I see Vitted everywhere for the past 6 years. You know, and then I say, well, it's almost 20 years old. They go, what were you doing for the last 20 years? But it takes many years of building up confidence for the people who are receiving the product. So we have to get distributors to deliver it. So we've been through about 4 different distributors. But about 7 years ago, we got with the distributor in Ireland, which changed the game for us here in Ireland. So the product was selling really well. We were with the previous distributor. That previous distributor was telling me that we were really successful. I was seeing our figures going up 40% year on year, but which was great. But yet, when I'd go out around sites in Dublin, I wouldn't see our products on the shelf all the time. So I felt something was wrong. So I got some data from a friend of mine who could afford the data. And I looked at it, and it actually said that Vithit had gone the previous year from being in 42% of stores across the country to 32% of stores. But yet our sales had risen by 40%. So what that told me was our distributors were doing a terrible job, but the brand was overperforming.
Okay.
So that's when I left, and we went to a new brand, or a new distributor. And they went from selling 6,000 cases the previous month to 33,000 cases in the next month. And from that point onwards, we've never sold below 50,000 cases. And that was about 7 years ago. So, you know, every month now in Ireland, we sell approximately 1 million bottles.
Every month?
Just in Ireland, wow. Yeah. So, you know, we had a great product, but you can have a great product, and if it never gets on the shelf, you're never going to succeed. So we now have a great distributor with us. And that success then has enabled us to spin off into various different countries, and then we put a flag in the next country, and then we move on. So it's like, you know, it's like kind of Risk, I suppose, if you ever played that game years ago. It was an 80s game, I think. But yeah, you'd make yourself big in one country and then attack another country attack another country. So yeah, we have everything down to maps, kind of like an old Risk game.
So when you've come off the road, things are really starting to tick, you've got your new distributor. What did you think then? What did you sit back and say, right, this is what we're going to do?
Yeah, I think your goals always change. They change every year. And, you know, if someone had told me we would be here today selling 25 million bottles across the globe year on year and growing at 30%, I wouldn't have believed it. But now we get here and you kind of go, right, how are we going to sell 100 million bottles? So that's that's really where you change. But yeah, we when we started that, I kind of affect that. What we do is we become successful now in one country and we keep one eye on that, but then we put our other eye into another country. So we went into the UK about 7 years ago.
Was that your first one after Ireland?
It was the first proper one, yeah. Few distributors had come to us in the past and taken us in small volumes, but never really hit properly. Actually, sorry, just before the UK, Iceland. We're actually the biggest selling health product in Iceland. Yeah, they drink 3 bottles per person per year up in Iceland. So
in Iceland?
Yeah. So we sell
huge. How did that happen?
I was just at a trade show and I had my stand, and this woman came up to me and she said, my name is Thora, we own a distribution company and I'm going to be a distributor in Iceland. And I'm looking around going, well, there's no one else here asking me to go to Iceland. So yeah, she's been fantastic. So that came there, and then I went into the UK, again, made a few mistakes, tried a couple of distributors, they failed. And so I hired one guy, which is now what we try and do. So I hired one guy, he was only 27 years of age, and he was pretty much an intern. And he started off, and he seemed to be the right kind of person for us. He really got into it, and he's now our commercial sales director in the UK.
So you'd hire one person per country to sell purely?
Yeah, that's kind of the model that we are doing now. So he started in the UK. He now has a team of five people around him. And, you know, sales in the UK last year was up 68%.
Wow.
So we're in Sainsbury's, Tesco, WH Smith, Boots, Marks & Spencer's, lots of independents. So the UK is a huge growth market for us. And we feel that that's going to be another massive growth market for us. And then out of the UK, then we've got, so we've become successful there. So then we move into Belgium, and then from Belgium, which is going really well, that same distributor wanted to take us into Holland. We've gone into Holland. We're looking at France at the moment. We've just launched in Australia and the UAE. So we've put an independent, a salesperson into both the UAE and Australia also.
Mm.
So yeah, a bit of traveling to kind of keep those guys going. But we found that's probably the best way, because even if you have a great distributor, you need to have your own guy on your team kind of showing them where to go.
Okay. Like what you were talking about earlier, the previous distributor was just not hitting the mark and you couldn't really tell.
Yes. Yeah. So we're always looking for information and figures. And if you don't have a guy in that country, the information comes slowly and it's too late to react. So it's like a shipping tanker versus a speedboat, you know.
Okay.
By the time you're trying to stop the tanker, you could be on the wharf and the speedboat can turn and go different directions.
Gotcha.
So we need information as soon as possible. So, you know, we're still learning. We only really decided that was our policy less than a year ago. So the bigger countries that we really care about. For instance, we just launched in Australia when I went there, and we've just hired a guy 2 weeks ago to be our main marker in Australia. We trained up a guy in the UK and put him down to Dubai, and he's now full time in Dubai, and we're looking for someone now to put them into Sweden as well. And we just hired about 2 months ago a person in France.
Okay.
So yeah, so effectively, and the other thing we do is we kind of like to have entrepreneurial people. So if I hire somebody, I basically tell them what I want and there you go, it's your job. If it flies, it's yours, and if it dies, we're going to have to let you go.
Okay.
So it's a very entrepreneurial company. I don't sit on someone's shoulder 24/7, but at the end of 2 or 3 weeks, we may have a phone call and see how you're doing, and if it's going well, great, and if it's not, we try and find out why, and we get you more training and try and help you and maybe go see some buyers with you, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it's a very entrepreneurial company. Like, you know, the person that we phoned, that we've hired in France, she probably started around 3 months ago, and I might have had one conversation a month with her in the past 3 months.
Mm.
So, yeah, she's doing a great job. We really need entrepreneurs in the company. That's the kind of people that we like to have.
It's a thread I see coming up a lot with very successful entrepreneurs. I spoke to Gareth Flower from Park P&P last week, and he said, hire hard, manage easy.
Yeah.
Very similar to yourself.
I like that, yeah.
Yeah, it was brilliant.
Yeah.
You can just identify with them, with the entrepreneurial spirit in them. If it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't.
Yeah.
How do you pick your countries? How do you say, right, okay, this one looks like... Is it all stats-based, or is it like a mixture of gut feeling and stats? What ways to work?
It's still kind of gut. We know... You could pick 1,000 products that are being launched this year, and I'd say probably 3 of them might work, might actually sell on the shelves. Like, it's like opening restaurants. It's a really, really difficult business. You see restaurants opening every day, and then 2 years later, they fail. You know,
I'm based in Temple Bar, and I walk through a street each week, and I'm like, that was definitely not here last week.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's mind-blowing.
There's low barrier to entry, but it's hard. It's a very high level of success, you know. So it's a similar thing with the drinks business. A lot of people think they can get into it, and a lot of people think they can succeed in it. Not all can. But we know this is one of these products that you put on the shelf, and VitHit means something in most countries, and we put it on the shelf in most countries, and in most countries it sells. It's the difficulty is actually getting it on the shelves.
Mm.
So if we get approached, we do one very large trade show every year in Europe, and if we get approached by a distributor, and if we believe, and it's kind of gut, we'll go meet them, etc., but if we believe that they're going to do a good job, we'll give it a shot. We don't actually have to put in much investment into it. Obviously, you have to, you know, back up a little bit of marketing, social media, that kind of stuff. We know how to do that. But yeah, it's still a bit of gut feeling. We still fail with distributors. The product really never fails. You know, if we went up to Scandinavia a while back to Norway, and we just had a distributor which just wasn't good enough, and they just weren't pulling in the figures, so we had to let them go. But we looked at the retail stores they were in, and our product was really outperforming the competition.
Mm.
But yet, that's when we went up there to have a look at it. But when we were talking to the distributor, they were kind of like, oh, it's going okay. Mm. You know, so you really have to just dig under the covers a little bit to see what actually is happening. And plus, again, back to my belief in myself and in the company, like if someone tells me it's not selling, I just don't believe them.
Okay.
It just...
Because you have so much data from other countries and other places.
I mean, and one of the things that gave us success in other countries is once we became successful in Ireland, we went over to the UK and they didn't believe a word of it. But once you become successful in the UK, so you can say to someone, we are the best-selling product on the shelves at Sainsbury's, or the best-selling product on the shelves at WH Smith or Boots.
It means a lot.
Then you can go to people in France, Spain, Belgium, Germany, and then they go, oh, that makes sense to them, you know?
And then how do you launch into a new country? Do you have to do a big marketing spend, or do you find the product actually moves itself?
The product moves itself, and if you ever tell a distributor or retailer that, they don't believe you.
Even if I was saying it out loud there, it sounded ridiculous.
Yeah, it does sound ridiculous, but it does. You put it on the shelf against the previous market leader, we will always match them and pretty much outsell them straight away. And it's happened in 12 countries now, so again, I'll always believe that it's going to work. But yeah, we don't just expect it to sit there. We have a social media and marketing team here, and we will do highly targeted, like laser targeting ads. So let's say if we're going into Sweden, we'll be targeting young people from 18 to 35 with ads, telling them about, you know, what's so great about Vithit and that kind of thing.
And that's centrally managed here?
Yes. Yeah, and we can. So we are managing all 12, 13 of our countries from here. With our social media targeting. So we'll invest certain amounts and hit them in capital cities.
Okay, and why was the decision to keep that central? Just for control, or what way does that work?
Well, I mean, with the World Wide Web, you can control things from a bedroom, you know? Mm. A lot of the biggest companies in the world now were started up in people's garages. And it's the beauty of e-commerce today is that you can actually sell everything. You can become a worldwide widget expert from your room in Rathfarnham, and you know, there's lots of opportunities out there for people. So again, we don't have huge budgets to do outdoor advertising in countries, but what we are very good at is targeting people, the right type of people. You know, so if we want college kids, you know, in the capital city, we can target them. You know, if we want, you know, plumbers in Perth, we can target them. So we know how to target the exact people. Whereas if you put outdoor advertising up, you don't know who you're getting. You could get a grandmother who's 90 years of age, whose eyesight isn't good enough to see it, or who doesn't drink Fitit, or you could get a 70-year-old golfer who drives by, who you could target him on Facebook, but you know, he's not going to see your ad on it. So it just means you know who you're hitting, and we can get stats back to see exactly who we've hit and how we've hit them. So we've become good at that over the last few years.
You've touched on something there I wanted to ask you about. Do you think it's easier to start a business now compared to when you started, or is it harder because there's more competition?
Oh, gosh, it depends on the business, I think. I would always say, you know, people put too many barriers in front of themselves. Like, both my parents were entrepreneurs, so I was kind of born thinking business is easy. It's never easy, but I guess, let me rephrase that. Business is... it's not easy, but it's easy to enter. And, you know, I didn't have any mental blocks with entering business. So, you know, the internet is just so accessible for people. You know, and the more bizarre your business, the better.
You know, there's a niche for everything now.
There's a niche for everything. Like, I had a young guy come to me recently, and he was saying, you know, he's making some hair products, you know, like gels and stuff like that. And I said, well, what's different about yours? It's going, well, you know, we're nice and whatever. And I was kind of going, yeah, but you need to make yours different. Like, why don't you make, you know, I have grey hair. You can't see this in the podcast, but why don't you make, you know, gel for guys with grey hair and then just target them online?
Yeah.
You know, there are millions of men with grey hair, you know, or ladies. So just find a little niche and don't just be the every guy. And that's when I entered this business. You know, there was obviously Club Orange, Fanta, 7-Up, Lucozade, all of those brands out there. But none of them were... I wasn't going to create another cola or another sports drink. Mm-hmm. You know, people say, oh, why don't you make a sports drink? Because there are other brands, Powerade, who have way more money than I do, and they can hit people, target them way easier, and they have much bigger budgets. So I wasn't going to do the same thing again. I want to take a business which has been, you know, cranking to a halt for years, as far as I'm concerned, and just make it a little bit different. And that's what we've done. So, you know, that would be the general mindset. So if you can find something that you're good at, you know, if you're looking outside and see plants, if you can become a horticulturist and, you know, have this a new miracle grow that's all natural or something like that. Mm. There's, you know, there's these things are right in front of our eyes everywhere. Just become a niche, and like the tiniest laser targeted niche, you can hit people all around the world. And as long as you can stick it in a pack and post it across the other side of the world and not pay too much high tax on it and make it profitable, it's really easy. So that is a very, very simple way, and not everybody has that. Other than that, you know, there is a lot of people getting into FMCG, which is fast moving consumer goods, which is what we're in. And yes, when we did it 20 years ago, even up to about 7 years ago, we were the only Irish company who had a stand at these European trade shows, maybe up to 6 or 7 years ago. The only one for 13 years, nobody else was there. And I used to always say, why are we the only ones? I never understood.
Am I a genius or am I mad?
No, no, my wife will tell you I'm definitely not a genius. No, I just didn't understand why other, like, you'd have English companies, you'd have companies from Malta, Spain, France, and for some reason, Irish companies just weren't it. Now, there are loads now, which is great. But I don't know, the long answer, long and short of it, you know, if your idea is good enough, there's never a bad time to start a business. Mm. If your idea is good enough and you can do your figures correctly, just get out and go do it. I mean, especially the younger you are, the faster you need to do it. Because when you get to my stage now, where I'm 48, I have a wife and a kid, now I have dependents. And if you were to ask me to go out and risk absolutely everything, house, car, everything like that, it's different. But when you're young and you have none of those barriers, stop playing video games, just get out and try something, just do it. And what's the worst that can happen? You can lose your savings. Big deal. You know, work harder, you'll make them again.
I think that's a very interesting point you made, though, about not having a barrier, not in your mind, not having that barrier. I think that's what everyone has. I think that's so many people I chat to that message me or whatever, especially since I started the podcast, they message me like, I have a great idea, but... And it's getting from that idea stage to the execution.
Yeah.
What advice would you... We just start. I guess you've just given it there in terms of what advice would you give to people who are trying, who are at idea stage and just can't seem to get over their mental block?
Yeah, go back to the ladybird version. I mean, just say, okay, you know, if I'm going to make... if I'm going to be the new... There's a wall outside here. So let's say if I'm going to be the new brick maker, you know, have eco bricks or something... Like, try and find out how much it's going to cost to get a minimum order made. So if that's going to be 10 grand and you only have 1 grand, how are you going to make your 10 grand? So literally bring it down to very simple form. And then say, okay, well, you know, I'm not going to charge myself for my own hours, so it's going to cost me 10 grand. That's going to take me a year and a half or 2 years to save and put that aside. And I'm going to focus 100% on that. So when I get my 10 grand, I'm going to start my business. And then you have a chance. But if you just keep putting these barriers in front of yourself the whole time, oh, wow, it's going to cost so much money. And you've never even made a phone call to find out how much it's going to be to get your bricks made. So take one. The advice I would give you is keep it really simple. Bring it down to what is it going to cost to get something done. And just take one step, even a minor step every day. 5 days a week, just take one minor step. And then you can go do what you want on the weekends. It's not the end of the world. And, you know, everybody has a lunch break. You know, you can be great if you could work, you know, two jobs and you can like get a lunch break and just make a step every day. You can email. There's so much accessibility. It took me 2 years to find a producer. Like, you literally put in into Google to anybody who can produce, and you'll get companies on Alibaba over in China. You can produce stuff, or you can get them produced anywhere in Europe. Like, that's so easy now to find things. So that finding something is a lot easier now than it used to be. So yeah, just make it really logical and simple and just start Googling and come up with what cost it's going to be and see if it's feasible, and then give yourself a year or two plan and save the money and just go do it.
If you were starting again, knowing what you know now, what would you do differently?
I would work for Coca-Cola, and I would...
I didn't see that coming.
Instead of making all my own mistakes, I would probably work for them for about a year and a half till I, you know about percentages and... You know, what products work, what products don't work, that kind of stuff. And so I'd make my mistakes in someone else's book. Whereas, you know, I went broke. I lost my house. I lost my car. You know, I went through a very tough time before the recession. And if I worked for somebody else and made my mistakes in somebody else's book, I would have made all those mistakes, got paid for it, and then started up my own business. But my fear was, whether it was true or not, I actually just about enough points to go to college. And here is my skewed logic. So I remember I drove down to Maynooth College, and I had enough points to do something that I had no interest in, arts. So anyway, I stood in the queue, looked around, and the car was, there was five of us in the car, and the other four people got in the car, and I was driving. They said, so what are you doing? I'm doing sociology. What are you doing? I'm doing geography. And they said to me, what am I doing? I said, I'm not going to college. And they were like, what? And I said, no, just college isn't for me. And they said, why? I said, well, I figure that if I go to college, I'll get a job, I'll get dependence, and I'll be stuck in a loop, and then I'll make more money in that job, and then I'll be afraid to leave that job.
Yeah.
And I'd rather have hardship early than have it late. Now, I don't know to this day whether that was, it was obviously the right thing for me, but I don't know.
That's big self-awareness though for an 18-year-old, whatever, 18, 19-year-old. That's massive self-awareness though.
Well, again, it was just me making something really simple.
It was
just like, you know, if I do that, you know, my dream was to always work for myself. I didn't like working for other people. So my dream was, and how can I get to my dream? If I go and work for someone else, I'm not going to enjoy it. I'm going to, you know, get 2 weeks holidays a year. I don't like that, you know. Yeah. So I wouldn't have been the master of my own destiny. If you'd have told me that it was going to take 13 years to break even, I probably would have gone, maybe I'll get a job.
That arts degree sounds pretty good.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And there were stages at which I would have, you know, when I was so down deep in a hole of debt, that if someone had taken them off me, the debt off me, I would have taken a job. But, you know, I had the all of the self-belief that I built up in school through sports and all that kind of stuff just stuck with me and got me to where we are now.
We have two final questions. You can think about the final one just for a second. I get people to recommend a book every week. Mm-hmm. Something that's kind of been an impact on them. So you can just think about that just for a minute. We'll ask you the second last question. You mentioned you did like a number of side businesses or side kind of income streams when you were starting off Fitted. Mm-hmm. How did you come up with those and how did you manage them in tandem with Fitted?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was probably another reason why Fitted took so long to succeed, because I was a kind of a half-baked property developer. I would like buy the odd apartment on plans. So when I got my first professional rugby contract over in the UK, I went straight out when it was easy to get a mortgage. Uh-huh. And I got a mortgage for a 2-bedroom apartment. I couldn't afford to live in said 2-bedroom apartment, so I rented it out. And I lived with a pal of mine in a bedsit. And that was my first property. And then as property prices were rising, I went back to the bank and I said, that property is worth another X amount. I'd like to take that money out, remortgage it, and put it on another property.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you can see where this is going.
This is easy, yeah. This is easy money.
This is easy. This'll never fail.
So I never lose money in bricks and mortar.
Yeah, exactly. So every time I would sell, I would take some money from that and put it into the business.
Okay.
Of which was another big black hole. So the business was losing money. So I guess, you know, I was, when you're focused on two things, you're not focused on one thing. Right. So I wasn't doing Vitted properly, and I wasn't really doing my development property. I was kind of half baked between the two of them. So then when the hidden blessing for me that the recession hit, I was like, wow, I need to really focus on something because property prices aren't rising anymore.
Okay.
And I had to really focus on the business. So that's kind of the simple version of it.
Okay. Yeah. You've baked that down for Ladybird
version. Yeah.
I love it. Last question. Have you read any books in the last couple of years that had a massive impact on you in terms of either your business or personally?
I'm into audiobooks now, so I kind of listen to them on my holidays.
That's a common trend. Yeah, yeah. A lot of you are recommending. We can do an Audible as well. We can do an Audible giveaway.
Yeah, yeah. So there's one book which has nothing to do with business, but I just loved it. I loved his attitude. There was an actor. It was a book called The Moon's a Balloon, a guy called David Niven. And he arrived into Hollywood at the age of about 30, kind of just decided he wanted to go start acting and became a really famous actor with all the famous Hollywood people like Clark Gable and Greta Garbo and all that kind of stuff. And his story is just really interesting and very irreverent type of fella, which is the kind of people that I'm drawn to.
Yes.
And I just thought that was an excellent book. I'm just touching over at the moment a book called Outliers, which when you have a kid, you kind of want to know, you know, what makes people successful. And it's just very interesting, you know, the whole 10,000 hours, you can become an expert at anything, which probably sits in when Vitted became successful at maybe 20,000 hours, I think. But the Outlier is very interesting in that they basically say that most kids who are born in January, February and March have more of a chance of making it in a sports school because they have, you know, between 6 and 9 months more growth in their bodies, and then they get put into elite schools, and then they become 5% better every year, and eventually they're 50% better than the other kids. So that really interests me. So I just thought that concept was very interesting. So both of those, but yeah, for kind of a good read and good fun read and get off business for a while, The Moon's a Balloon is a really good one by David.
You should also check out Atomic Habits if you're interested. You're reading about, you know, now that you're a parent, you're reading about little things to make people successful. Atomic Habits is a fantastic one. Okay. I recommend that one.
I'm on
reverse it. Recommendation. Gary, thank I'm you so much.
It. Cheers, appreciate it. Thank you very much.
And that was episode 25 of the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I did sitting down and chatting with Gary. It's a privilege to get to sit down and chat with such fantastic Irish entrepreneurs. If you want to win a copy of the book that Gary recommended, simply leave us a review on iTunes and send me a screenshot on social media or by email. Thank you so much to everyone that did it last week. It means a huge amount. It just helps get the podcast up the charts and help more people discover it. Thank you so much. Don't forget, next week we're taking a short break and we're back in 2 weeks with episode 26. Chat to you then, and thank you so much for listening.